You're here.
I'm here.
Can you hear me? And are you sure?
Is it all working? It's our perpetual fear.
It truly is. And these people who have these big setups, like, we need help. And it's not for me to ask for help.
It's but, look,
but we may need it.
It's maybe in our future, but it's down the road.
It's down the road, right? For now, I'm just going to varying degrees of volume on my phone. I'm sorry. How are you?
I saw the glass that you were using for tonight, and I got jealous that you have a fun glass.
I do.
So I'm using my Denver Broncos glass.
Because where's the fun in that, though?
I mean, it's at least not just like a plain wine glass.
You haven't said anything about the Nuggets winning. Maggie was my friend. Well, I shouldn't say names. My friend was going crazy.
Well, I mean, I'm very happy for them.
Oh, wow.
I just don't really care that much about basketball.
Oh,
like, damn. I know. I'm sorry.
People were just like tuned into every sport. Like, you have like a direct line at birth that just.
Do you hear me pouring the wine?
I do. I haven't even opened mine yet.
Well, I opened it.
Hey guys, welcome to Theology on the Rocks.
Welcome to Theology on the Rocks.
We're here.
We're going to tell you about our drinks in a moment, but I'm excited. We're back.
We're back because someone left us. I'm sorry. Not naming any names.
I had to go. I had to go watch my friend get married by Elvis, which
in Las Vegas.
It is exactly what you would think happens when you get married by Elvis.
They call it like, Sin City. Do you think the name is appropriate?
Absolutely. But this is not my normal Vegas trip. This is like,
I will like say, like, not to say what you were doing. Was we're going to talk about what real sin is later as I rant. But I just wondered
we were just like a little bit farther, like you know how Circus is like at the end of the strip. We were just on the other side of Circus, and so we weren't really like in the midst of it all. And the one time we went down into the strip proper and like went to the Bellagio, we were all like, okay, that was enough. Except for Nick, who's from England and was like really pumped about going to a proper Las Vegas club,
which I assume is just like a normal club, except for it's more expensive.
I don't know. I mean, so he kept asking me like, how much does it cost? And I was like, Nick, we're going to talk about the patriarchy and sexism later, but I'm here to tell you I've never paid to get into a club.
Oh my gosh. Have you not? Christy, like, you lived all those years in Scotland, you didn't pay once?
Well, no, like in Vegas, I didn't pay to get into a club.
Oh my gosh, girl, I thought you were
paid
saying
to get into clubs
in your life. I was like, what is
I'm
your
not that pretty. Remember, I have a face for podcasts.
No, I know. I just, like, my flabbergast was not at your beauty or skill. I was just amazed at. Like, I was just,
damn.
I wanted.
No,
I know. It really wasn't.
No, just in Vegas. Because they hand you out the free, like, tickets or whatever. Because you're a female. And
I've only been with my parents, so I don't know. I don't really know.
Well, yeah. So, yeah, I kept telling him, I was like, sir, I'm not the right one to ask how much it costs. I'm so sorry. But he did not make it to a club. And that's a story for not this podcast.
I think they made a movie about that.
It was very similar.
I don't think you have to tell the story.
It was very similar.
We will just direct you towards a movie with Bradley Cooper. Speaking of sin, did you hear... That
we are sinning right at this moment.
That we are sinning, and I am really sinning.
You are really sinning because you're ordained.
I am.
I at least.
You're midway sinning.
I'm midway sinning.
So you guys know, if you've followed me at all, that I grew up Southern Baptist, and the Southern Baptist Convention met this week, still meeting, still spewing their
still doing the thing.
And the president, who I won't say his name because honestly, I don't care to, and I don't have to because it's my podcast, but you can look it up if you really care.
We don't have to taint our podcast like that.
I don't want to put those vibes out in the world, but anyway, he can go screw himself. I'll put that vibe out in the world, and by screw, I mean fuck himself. So he's head of the Southern Seminary and all the anyway, it's just been the sort of. You know, I won't even say throughout my life that it's been like, you know, a thing that's deeply hurt me, but I will say that it's been a thing that's just it deeply hurt me when I was younger.
Yeah.
But now it's just like, you know, that friend you bring to a party who's always a drag.
Yes.
That's the Southern Baptist Convention to me. It's just like perpetually a drag. Like I go on, I'm not even a part of it. I'm ordained in the Disciples of Christ. I've moved on, but
you've moved
they
on.
Just, it's just like, I show up to a party.
Similarly, AKA yeah.
Twitter, and they're just moping in a corner somewhere.
I've never been Southern Baptist, and I've never been to a Southern Baptist church.
I mean,
but I've been evangelical, which is really just Southern Baptist in hiding.
I mean, the church I grew up in was fine. Like, I mean, did it have questionable
I don't know that it's because, you know, theology, the probably. SBC, the, if you look at their history, it's not, well, like if you go way back, it's bad.
But, well, we learned because I went to a Baptist seminary actually. And I mean, it was CBF, not SBC, but you know, I had to take Baptist polity and we learned, you know, the four fragile freedoms and autonomy of the church. I mean, they're based on this kind of freedom that you don't see in the sort of hierarchy of like the Presbyterian or Anglican church. And they thrived on that. But what happened is like, and I kind of get it because, you know, I always tell my students I'm a benevolent dictator in the classroom. And it's like, because you have too much freedom and then there's just nothing.
Yeah.
You're nothing anymore.
You're not doing anything anymore. Yeah.
And so I think that's maybe what happened with them is that they, I mean, I'm one to talk. You should look at the mantras of the disciples, i.e. there are none. But I mean, you know, I think it just got to be where some conservative branches were like, we're straying too far off.
Yeah. I think we can really look back to a certain time period in the U.S. When, and this is not the history we're going over today, but the idea that
it's just I'm mad. So.
The idea that reaction to certain things going on in the U.S., namely like the like hippie culture of the 60s and 70s.
And women's rights.
Women's rights.
Civil rights.
Civil rights, etc. A lot of reactions were to get more conservative and kind of like close ranks on that. And I think that's where the Southern Baptist Convention started doing that. But I don't think it's like everything else. Like it takes a decade or two to really be like, oh, this is terrible, you know?
And it just keep like I went to a Baptist undergrad too, but it was sort of I teach at a Methodist, it's very loose.
Yeah.
And when I was leaving, which was in 2004, the Southern Baptist had tried to take back over the school. So that's what I'm talking about. The person who just keeps popping up to the parties and like all my favorite professors, they were moving them to like history and all of this, which is what they do out of religion. And
I'm I have my own experiences with certain Southern Baptist people. So I just avoided looking at a lot of things because I was like, this is just going to make me start raging. But I already know
I wouldn't go on Twitter.
I was like, we're avoiding that today.
My husband, who did not grow up in the church culture that we grew up in, he came walking in from work like 5 minutes ago. And usually when Christy and I record, he just takes the dog and goes away. And I said, he walked in and sort of looked at the mail and he was like, hey, how are you doing? And I was like, I don't know. I'm just really mad at guys today. And he was like, I know. Because he's been reading me stomping like a troll across all of social media. And he just kept his head down and was like, I know. And then he was like, I'm going to take the dog and let you talk. It's like, this is our therapy.
I mean, it kind of is. It's, you know, it's a good release of certain things and getting out into the world. But I just, you know, I had a professor at seminary once who, this is after I graduated, I went back to chat with him about like my, I basically, before I decided to do the PhD, I like interviewed all of my like past professors and advisors about like how best to be in academia and like good tips and tricks and whatnot. And I don't remember exactly the conversation, but this man who never says a direct thing ever, like we used to call him Dr. Disclaimer. He looked at me and he goes, those Southern Baptists are real jerks. And it was like, I almost died of shock. I was like, oh my goodness.
I think at the core of my being, because full disclosure, I grew up my whole life in a Baptist church in my town in Georgia, Southern Baptist Church. My grandma went there. My mother was married there. Like, yeah. I had my whole life there. I ate potluck there. And it pisses me off because I enjoyed my time there. Again, I had theological questions. I didn't always agree with what was going on. But it makes me mad because it's like, why do you get to take that away?
Yeah.
That memory. Which, like, why did I have to leave that home to find a place to justify, not justify, but to acknowledge my calling?
Yeah.
You know,
I think that's how I feel about evangelicalism as a whole too, because while I have some weird stories and stuff, I was definitely one of the ones who got out relatively unscathed. And like, I can look back at certain memories fondly, but I also, it's like taint. It's, I mean, now you're also looking back at those memories and thinking like, oh, but my friend over here is probably like really struggling or being tortured or whatever you want to say, you know?
Yeah. And they're not going to, I mean, my next two books, the Southern Baptists, are not going to come out well. I'm sorry.
I'm shocked.
I know, bad theology, right? But I do want to say at the core of my being is that when I passed that church that I grew up in, I have nothing but memories of my grandma and my grandpa and love and adoration and learning to play piano and, you know, dressing up as a sheep by putting a sweater inside out and, you know, those kinds of things. You know, trying not to talk too loud so the old ladies wouldn't look at you, but like, and I just, that's what makes me angry. I think if it had been just completely bad, that I could
leave it behind without as much like sadness,
right? You could just say that was an abusive relationship and I escaped. Mm-hmm. I don't feel like I escaped. I feel like I was forced to leave. Same. And I think that's what I'm seeing play out.
Yeah, same. I totally feel that way. I feel that way completely,
and it pisses me off.
Yeah.
Because who are these motherfuckers who get to decide? Where are the people? Whatever. I'm done now. And then again, my last thing is on, you and I talked about this. I had to call Christy and rant about it before. There's a lot more expletives. Again, I'm a redneck, but like, they were talking about Beth Moore and like recording all these people. And I was just like, you know, who are sort of, they're putting up on these pedestals. And I was saying, you know, I was in Bible studies with Beth Moore stuff. And like, I'm glad she's getting out. But you and I both agreed that what would also be cool is maybe she points to alternative voices with her platform.
Yeah.
And that we shouldn't just lift them up as people who escape, but actually for them to use it to say like, I was wrong about this.
I was wrong about this. How about I stop talking for a minute and you all go listen to these people who are the people that either helped me out or people who understand better or something, because certainly what we need right now is not the voices of like the very privileged.
Right. And we're two people to talk, but I mean, at least, so if Beth Moore, you want to come on, our podcast. We'd love to have you. And
love to have her.
And we could, you could find some people to point to, because I think that's one thing that women in academia, well, women in theological academia do especially, is that we point to each other.
Yes.
And say, hey, look at this person. And I hope I always do that.
Yeah. You are good at, you are very good at it.
You are excellent too. And I mean, it's one of these things where knowing we don't know everything.
Yeah. Well, it's that humility, but it's also being trained by other and brought up by other women who are really intentional of it. Like, again, just going to keep my constant adoration for my supervisor, Heather Walton, because that's what she does for everyone. And
she does. She did it for me as well. And we worked together. Yeah. She guided me on the right path.
There's so much support that you don't see in a lot of areas in academia. And academia can be so toxic, but like, you get into these good places with these women doing theology in new and different ways. And it is like living in a cozy blanket, because you're just surrounded by warmth and love. So
yeah, and my corner was my, I had a female supervisor as well, Cecilia Clegg, and I was in a corner of New College that was very not very well worn at Edinburgh, with, you know, Marcella and Cecilia and women who were in that, and the kind of ghosts of women past.
Yes.
We've spoken about Elizabeth Templeton and stuff on this podcast. But Celia Clegg was my professor, and she taught me that too. And I think there is something about women supporting women, and indeed other marginalized groups, which actually does segue into what we're talking about.
I was going to say, it's a perfect segue into our today, because today,
and I need wine.
You need to pour your wine.
I'm going to put you down, but you maybe talk about what we're going
to
just.
Yeah. Like. I'll introduce us. So, to start with, you may have noticed, so we keep, telling y'all on the Instagram that we have a guest today, and we do. But we thought Leah and I could get our typical banter, because that's what we do. What we're going to talk about today is liberation theology. We're going to start with some big changes that came in the 60s? 50s, 60s, something like that. That's Leah's area. I know when the Great Schism happened, and that was 1054.
I'm also not looking at anything. So I'm just like, sure.
And we're going to talk about the different ways, the different branches of liberation theology. And then Columba is going to come on, and he is going to teach us and talk to us about his experience with queer theology. But we're really excited about today. I'm just going to say it's going to be a long one. So buckle up.
It is. It is. And I'm going to actually sit down, if my cat will let me sit down and try to calm down. I don't usually get worked up in my old age, but I got triggered today. Christy. I got triggered. I had to go on a real long run before we started. But now I'm doing better because I have wine. Ooh, we should talk about the wine. So,
Columba picked the drink of the week, and he picked wine, and he's going to tell us about his wine, but it was like a pick your favorite wine. So Leah, what are you drinking?
So I'm drinking a very, very full bodied Cabernet. And I know that sounds basic. It's not a Merlot, if you guys seen Sideways, but it's a Cabernet, a full bodied Cabernet. I usually go for Portuguese or Spanish Cabernets or Malbecs. I don't even know. Wait, no, what is it? Yeah, sure. We'll go with that. If that's wrong, it's wrong. I'll do it. I'm freaking sorry. But anyway, and so I usually go for ones that are just like hit you in the teeth kind of red wines. Those are the ones that I like. It should be noted that also I drink any red wine.
Yes.
It's in a box. I don't mind.
If it's red.
Yeah. If it's red.
I are happy. I do I like the really bold ones though, where it feels like you've been punched in the mouth and then all of the moisture is sucked out.
Yeah. A Rioja. That's what I was trying to think of. Rioja is the one that I like the most. They didn't have Rioja, so I got a Cabernet.
Cabs are great.
Yeah, I like it's. This is from California, which sure, whatever, California, it's fine. But like, I do. Rioja is probably my number one, but this is going to be amazing and delightful. So, I mean, I can't say anything about California because Georgia wine tastes like your teeth are going to fall out whenever you drink it. So,
yeah,
it's not one. I'm not a sommelier. So,
no, I mean, I really just, if the only way I really know what's happening is if I feel like I've lost all of the moisture in my mouth. But I'll drink every red wine.
What is yours of tonight?
Well, actually, so as I say that, I decided because it is the devil's butthole in Florida right now.
And truly. Here as well. When I said I ran, it was a bad mistake.
I cannot handle how hot it is.
Did you get a rosé?
I decided to go with a rosé.
Oh my gosh.
Which is, there's only one rosé that I truly enjoy. And I have to tell you, it's hilarious. I mean, I'll drink rosés. It's usually a day drink for me or like at the beach or something, but it's still a million degrees outside. So, but this one we discovered when we were living in Glasgow, Leah and I both had this amazing wine and spirit merchant called Inverarity, and the two guys that ran it, Smiley Pete and Andy, who I thanked in my dissertation, by the way.
Brilliant. They also ran my a bachelorette party
They did Leah's hen do. They did one of my birthday parties. They would do these tastings, and they introduced me to this wine at this tasting. And we were not sober when we first had it, but I just kept yelling, I need a big hat and a beach. And so that is, I call it my big hat beach wine, but it is Hampton water.
Well, that's not the only thing you call it. But
I know it's not the only thing. but it's made by John Bon Jovi's son. So it's like.
Nepo baby wine.
It's like people don't take it seriously because it's like a celebrity wine, you know, but it's actually quite tasty. You've had it. You liked it.
Oh, I drank the crap out of it. Problem is this, but my problem with rosé is not that it's rosé, is that I just don't know I'm drinking it, but my body knows that it's drinking
it. It goes quick.
And then I'm like, oh, really? But I don't feel like it. You know, some things, because I typically drink things like, my go-to drinks are like tequila, red wine, and like ciders. You know when you're drinking them, like, you know, or whiskeys. Yeah, you know when it's happening.
Yeah,
it's happening. Rosé, you just don't know.
Rosé, you just are drinking. Same with gin, which is, I think, why I really like to drink gin. During the day, is because it's like
I can do it.
I'm like happily like drinking my gin and tonic and just moving around and not driving, because that would be terrible. But like having a really lovely day, and then the night comes and I'm like, oops.
I made a mistake.
I have made an error.
That's what I felt when I went to see Christy in Florida last. We drank this wine. And it's so hard for me not to call it the other name, but we drank this wine. And
DM us for the secret nickname.
I was going to say, that may be some sort of unlocked thing. And then you can finally find out my other perfect album as well. But I drank it, and then I was like, well, this is fine. And then when I looked, and it was like all gone. And I was like, oh, this is fine. And then I went up to get up to the bathroom, and I was like, I'm not fine.
Oh, no, everything is not fine. Yeah, it's going to be
there you go.
Well, Leah, start us off by teaching us about Vatican II.
Yes, as a Catholic scholar, I am not. However, but what I will tell you is that, and again, I don't use notes, which maybe we should. I don't know, but it's in my brain, maybe. So if it's wrong, I'm really freaking sorry. The Vatican II, the first, let me get back. So my dissertation, I talked about the theology of reconciliation. So I had to talk about Vatican II, and I'll tell you why in a minute. Did you already drink this, by the way? I'm clearly already drinking.
Oh, yes. No, I've been drinking.
Okay, that's fine.
I almost have to refill.
The story is like a spider web already. So but I'll hit as to why it was important, the reconciliation stuff. But anyway, liberation theology comes out of really the Second Vatican Council, which there had been one previously in like the 1800s. I think it was like the late 1800s. And
was it, I thought it was like the 1600s, but again, this is not my area.
I think it was the 1800s. I mean, do you have your computer?
Hold on. You keep talking.
I think it was the late 1800s, but I don't know. I mean, let's just be, let it be known there's been two of them so far. If we think that the church started when it started, there's been two. So.
Oh, yeah. 1869.
Boom. Mic drop. I have no idea. Look, I didn't know what date it was. It's not like the Great Schism. I just vaguely knew when it sat in my brain. So anyway, the Second Vatican Council was, I think, in the 1960s is what's coming into my head. Christina,
I'm trying. It didn't come up quite as quickly.
Oh, okay, but
it lasted.
Yeah, it was over a course of several years.
Yeah, it lasted for several years, but it ended in 1965.
There you go. Awesome. So we know what time period we're in now, which is that time period. And essentially, the Vatican councils are when a certain pope or group of people within the church, Catholic Church specifically, decide that, you know, we maybe need to like evaluate where we are in terms of the world. And so the world was, this time period, if you look even globally, was changing really rapidly. And I think the church was feeling a bit nervous about that. And so, instead of, you know, like the Southern Baptist saying exactly how you're supposed to act in the world that you live in, the Catholic Church said, maybe we should look at the world and see what the world is doing, you know, and think about that. And so that's what they did. I will say, you know, there's books on Vatican II, and you can look at the different sort of reports that came out of it. They're pretty, like, and again, we'll bring a Catholic scholar on here that can confirm or deny, but they're pretty minimal from what I read. Like, it's not, like, huge things that are happening. One of the big things that actually came to be was a little more of an emphasis on being okay with Protestants. But, I mean, it was, like, a little shift.
They were like they're instead of calling them demons, we're gonna call them lesser brothers.
Right. Like there's some line, it's like you're not in full communion, but like you're in there. But like which actually is pretty damning because communion is important to the Catholic Church. But anyway, not a Catholic scholar. I'm here for the historical event. So it happened, they were evaluating, blah blah blah. So when that happened, as I said, there's all these reports that came out, and the problem with church reports, and this is in the Protestant church and the Catholic, this is all across the board, is it's not always readable to humans because it's being written by really sort of high academic people, if you want to call them that, or they're just not writing for other people except their peers to understand. And so you get some groups of mostly priests in Latin America who come together and they want to kind of interpret what Vatican II means for them as priests, as local priests, but also just like the everyday person. And so you get this council that comes out of it's S-E-L-A-M, but because of my accent, I perpetually would just say Salem, say lamb, say lamb. But this is basically a group of priests that get together that are like, you know, let's try to interpret this and see what's coming out of these documents. Because, you know, they were very faithful to the Catholic Church, and they wanted to, you know, interpret it accordingly. And one of those priests is someone called Gustavo Gutierrez, and he is someone who is interpreting alongside a bunch of other priests as well. And
you may remember him from The Man That I Married During.
Which was a good idea.
Yes.
Looking back on it, he's probably one of the only ones we didn't get a lot of dirt on.
We didn't get any dirt on him.
I don't think Gustavo had any dirt. He may be a communist, but I mean, I think that he already probably, I mean, I'm also a communist.
Right. It's like, it'd be great to do company there.
I mean, yeah, I don't, it's a common thing that happens. Read my book, Bad Theology. You can see where I got called a communist in a research seminar. but anyway, so he basically, and Gustavo is important, and I point him out. There's a lot of people in this group, but he actually is going to become the, quote, father of liberation theology. Yes. And out of this meeting, there's two main themes that come out that these priests have decided is kind of what is being said. And that is liberation and reconciliation.
Yeah.
And at a very practical level. And so this is kind of where we see the start of liberation becoming this theme. Now, did the Catholic Church agree with those interpretations? No, they did not. but that's what came out.
That's what happened.
So let's fast forward to Gustavo Gutierrez. He is a Peruvian, I think. And he is a priest, and he basically writes a lot. He's a formally trained theologian. He actually trained in Europe, which you can see influences him quite a bit in his writings. But he writes the theology of liberation, and he kind of kickstarts this movement of liberation theology, which in Gustavo's mind is this idea of. And again, I'm not a Gutierrez scholar, but the summary is it's this idea that essentially the church, and in his world as the Catholic Church, has been too ecclesiastically focused. So it's too much about the church. And that's a big word for the church, basically. It's just been too focused on the church and too focused on, in many ways, going through the church to get to salvation. And to get to heaven, in other words. And he thinks that in the midst of all of that, that there's been something missing. And the thing missing is looking around us and basically seeing whose voice is getting lost. And that's a real important bit of liberation theology is who is the voice that's getting lost in the midst of this kind of top-down approach. Even with Christy and I, when we talk, you know, there's voices that are getting lost in the midst of us being, you know, educated and upper middle class and all of that kind of stuff too. Mm-hmm. So he believed that the poor and the poor are very widely kind of understood. So the poor were, he said, the preferred kind of children of God, as it were. And he doesn't mean that, like, you know, the poor are the ones that are, you know, essentially going to heaven and the rich people won't. He just thinks that if you really want to see the face of God and what God is doing in the world, that you need to look around, and the poor are the face of God in the midst of the world, and that your salvation isn't through this kind of hierarchy that is the church, but instead is done through trying to dismantle systems of oppression and the poor for the, you know, poor in whatever way you understand that. That becomes quite controversial for people because, well, it basically says you don't need the church, but it also says that your salvation is worked out in the world as opposed to, you know, a relationship that you have. And I think I will not speak for him because I do not know him, but I would say he would argue that having that relationship means you do things in the world. But again, that's my interpretation of it. So that's Gustavo Gutierrez, and that's liberation theology. And what we see is that from him and that group of Latin American priests who then go out into the world of Latin America, they set up these, what they called base communities, which were basically where people in different communities, a lot of poor communities, would sit around and, I mean, essentially do kind of a Bible study, really, and talk about what they think that it means for them. And so it wasn't a priest telling them anymore. It was them interpreting it for themselves. And from that, we get a whole lot of different spring-offs, I would say, of different kind of theologies. One of the things that comes directly from Latin American liberation theology is something called Stassi Diaz, she writes about Mujerista theology, which is Latin American, basically feminist theology. And she says, you know, okay, you think the poorest of the poor will imagine being Latin American and also a woman, you know? And so you get that kind of thing that comes out from that world. I get pretty annoyed when people, what tends to happen in systematic theology, is that liberation theology gets called contextual theology.
Yeah, which it shouldn't, because everything is contextual.
Yes, it's this idea that, well, oh, the, you know, Black theology, queer theology, feminist, all that is being done from a context and it's through your own window, as though, you know, white European male theology is somehow done in some vacuum. That's right. Not contextual. I mean, it's a discredit. It's trying to discredit it, basically.
Like, we even saw last time was that everything Bart is doing is in the context of World War II. You know, I think the main difference, and this is like massively splitting hairs and semantics and stuff, is that Bart then is like, my context is informing my theology, but my theology is universal, where a lot of the liberation theologies are like much more comfortable saying this theology is specifically helping certain groups or certain people, and everybody should know it, but like,
yeah,
and our focus is this subset, you know?
As if we don't do that. I mean, do you think Bart was taught?
No, absolutely. I'm just saying, like, I think liberation theology is much more self-aware.
Oh, yeah. No, I agree with that. I think reflection there. And Bart, I just saw that your friend came
back. The Germans are like, we're for everybody.
Right. And if someone in, let's say, Latin America read Bart, they would probably be like, what are you talking about? So it isn't, actually.
Right.
Yeah. For everybody. Yeah. Anyway, hi, Columba. I saw that you came in.
Yes.
Hi. I snuck in.
We thought that because we wanted to talk about some of these offshoots of theology, that Columba was going to be a great one. I want to just do a like quick intro. Columba and I actually were at Glasgow together, also studying under Heather, so we can continue to sing her praises just constantly.
such fan people, my gosh.
But now you serve as the rector of St. Mark's Church in, is it Penyan?
Penyan, yes.
Penyan, okay. New York, which is a part of New York I didn't know existed until we moved there. And
is it New York State or New York City?
New York State.
Okay. I mean, I figured it's a big place.
Is it like I don't know where, like, can you explain where it is? Because I looked it up and then I immediately forgot it.
Wow. So it is yeah, that makes me feel special. Thanks. So it's in the sort of ambiguous area that is either central New York, Western New York, or the Finger Lakes region. Conveniently it is, I mean I can look out my window here and see a lake, so I go with Finger Lakes. But we're about 2 hours east of Buffalo and an hour and a half west of Syracuse and an hour south of Rochester.
Wow. Okay. You're just right in the middle.
Well, sure. Yeah.
that means no, but okay.
Yeah. I mean,
she's a podcast host, you have to say yes.
He's never agreed with me a day in our lives.
I was gonna say, I don't think that's gonna go well.
I think that's okay. Christy and I very rarely agree on anything. Look at our Twitter.
One of the people in my life that I have I met, and immediately I said, I literally said to him, we're gonna be friends now, I'm just warning you.
She's told me this story about multiple people, and I'm wondering if you're just kind of scooping up random people, but they're unsuspecting victims.
They're always of your friendship. They're always unsuspecting. They're always, you know, that meme about like introverts make friends with extroverts because the extrovert just like adopts them. I'm just like very upfront about it. I'm like just gonna literally tell you, hello, I am your friend now.
I mean, that's very fair. I will say that I don't think I felt bullied into it.
That's good. You had consent. You had consent to be friends with Christy.
I guess, and if he had said, like, no, absolutely not, I would have been like, okay, fine.
I pushed her down the first time that I met her and told her to get away from me.
Oh, wow. That's intense.
I know. I didn't really.
She didn't, but she...
I just yelled at her. It was fine. There was no physical, like, violence involved.
She just walked away. It was the same.
Actually, I did. We've heard this story on here before.
It's fine.
So tell us about your wine, Chloe, because I am deeply inspired by you picking this week.
The wine, yeah. So the Finger Lakes region is known for its vineyards. So it's the sort of second fastest growing vineyard industry in the United States, behind Sonoma and Napa counties. And my wine is a Grüner Veltliner from Weiss Vineyards, which is down sort of the south end of Cuca Lake. I live at the north end of Cuca Lake.
Okay.
So it's local. It's just from the wrong end of the lake.
Wow.
Super local.
Christy, mine's from California.
Mine's from France. So
I don't think we have a leg to stand on.
We don't. I don't think you can argue that, yeah.
No, what, not at all.
What kind of wine is it?
It's a Grüner Veltliner. So it's a white wine that's very dry, but very palatable.
I just want to point out that we have the Trinity of Wines represented here.
Because you have a rosé.
I have a rosé and Leah has a red.
Christy is 15 again, and she's drinking a rosé.
I don't know that it's an issue of again. I think Christy has just remained 15.
Never stopped being 15.
Yeah. Yeah.
Rosé is the gateway wine, is what people would always tell me.
I think that's accurate.
So we thought that we would, because I've done this sort of like explanation of like my drinking wine version of Vatican II and Latin American theology, liberation theology. But what happens next is sort of a succession. Whatever. Things happen. And you get like women's rights and civil rights, and you did, Christy said queer theology, but correct me if I'm wrong, that doesn't, not the gay rights movement, but queer theology doesn't come at least into prominence till like, is it the 90s or a bit later? Or
yeah, the sort of early mid 90s.
Yeah.
And it really evolves out of queer theory. Leaning more toward the sort of feminist theory side of things, but
yeah. So we thought, you know, you've got feminist, black, womanist, queer. I've done some stuff in disability theology, which comes out of a lot of Nancy Island, and then also some of the Scottish context. But we thought we would just kind of throw around some of these and talk about them, because one of the things that happens with Gutierrez is when he opens up this idea that, you know, especially with the base communities, that you can do theology in your house with your friends. And even if you don't fit into the church anymore, you can, you know, do that. And all of a sudden it opens up this world of, you know, theology happening on the ground.
Is it Marcella that says to do theology in your underwear?
She probably would be less than that. You can do theology in anything.
And not your underwear.
Yeah. Right. I think I know she does it in fetish boots at one stage, but
yeah.
I think I talked a lot about Gutierrez. Christy, do you want to talk about
black
womanist theology?
Yeah, quick, like so feminist theology as a kind of broad stroke starts starts actually a little bit before, but 50s and then 60s, again, working alongside the women's movement, second wave feminism. But a lot of the feminists responding to the men, specifically on the issue of sin, which is a topic for a podcast we'll do someday. But and saying
we already talked about it today,
saying that men's definition of sin as pride and like being too egotistical was not helpful for women, because women are inherently self-giving, and so there's a lot of kind of women's sin is self-negation instead of pride. So again, kind of the same ideas, but most of that feminist theology is coming from, again, white women in very privileged spaces. When the civil rights movement also is happening, we get James Cone, who is probably the most important or famous in Black theology, who was working off of a kind of understanding of Karl Barth's work, but he really is focusing on oppression in terms of the struggle of Black Americans. And you'll see him talking quite a bit about lynching and the ways that certain aspects of the Bible are especially helpful for Black American experience. So things like Exodus and the idea of escaping slavery, but also the idea of Jesus being multiply oppressed because he was not just Jewish in a Roman empire, but he was also Nazarene and things like that. And then there are multiple others, but Martin Luther King Jr. also takes part in this as well. But so you have both of those things going on. And then you get my favorite part of it, which is womanist theology. And womanist theology comes from a definition by Alice Walker, who says that womanism is to feminism like lavender is to purple. And so it's really feminism for Black women, and talking about their intersectional oppressions, the ways that they are both oppressed by society at large because of their Blackness, but even also Black men because they're women. And so they do a lot of work with that. And I did a lot of work on my dissertation with Katie Cannon, who did womanism in terms of a look at literature and the works of Zora Neale Hurston specifically, and how Black women show up for their community, Black women sacrifice for their community. She talks a lot about chattel slavery in that as well, but also the ways that Black women are able to save their community. It's a really interesting and kind of poignant way of looking at literature as being kind of helpful to understand what Black women are going through, and how that relates to our development of theology.
And Union Seminary becomes this kind of, in New York, I should say, becomes kind of hotbed for all of that sort of
stuff
so that you talked about.
A whole lot of people coming out of that and doing more and more work on it. Sean Copeland and Kelly Brown Douglas, who Columba studied under as well, and some other women who just do really pivotal work. And you can see that also reflected in a lot of the women who are doing more public theology and kind of dealing with womanist issues in public spaces on Instagram. There's a ton of them who are doing fantastic work just through through their platforms on Instagram, and we can link a bunch of those people as well. But
And some shout outs too to some of the feminist writers, you know, Mary Daly, Vera and Ruther, and those folks.
Valerie Saving, I think, wrote one of the most important first works. Kind of again, what I was referencing before about self-negation for women. Elizabeth Schulzer Fiorenza redoing some hermeneutics or some understanding of the Bible.
Oh gosh, I remember the first time I read Phyllis Trible. I read her in seminary, and I was just Trible, like, yeah. Man. So Phyllis Trible writes a book called Texts of Terror, amongst other things, and she's writing about women. I think specifically in the Old Testament. You can correct me if I'm wrong. Mm-hmm. And it's, you're like, man, yeah. This was terrifying.
Right? Yeah. I mean, it's really, I think it's really interesting. And we also get conversations between them. Like we were talking about before, like these women were writing back and forth to each other. And then I think it's important also just to keep, you know, kind of thinking about the ways that liberation theology, it's not doing like itself in a vacuum of itself either. Like these people were interacting with the systematic theologians, calling out some of their stuff. It was really just kind of making theology into that conversation that it should be. Like, you've said these things, right. They're helpful, but they're not quite right, or they're not complete, or we need to make some asterisks. Asterisks is a hard word to say when you've had some rosé.
That's what the rosé does. Loose lips.
It's you just start getting a lot of those back and forth, and I think that's a really important part of how theology works, is that it's supposed to be, like we're doing now, having a conversation about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think I always love the story, which I think is true. I mean, again, it's a story, but for Mary Daly, when she was at, what was it? Boston College? I don't know. My brain. Wine. I think it's Boston
College. That sounds right.
It's that part of theology is knowing a lot of facts about a lot of people. Having little cards. But she taught a class and discovered that the women weren't speaking up in the class. And so she asked if the guys would mind. I don't know if she asked. I think she told.
I doubt she asked.
I was going to say, I think she told.
Mary Daly was not an ask person.
She's not at all. She's a badass. But basically, she was like, girls only in this class, because she noticed that the dynamic wasn't working. Like, women weren't speaking in the classes. And she said she would tutor the men separately if they wanted to have the class, so that they could still have the class, which I thought was quite generous, because she at that stage probably could have just
she started her own way of writing the English language, so
she could do what she wanted to do.
She just did what she wanted to do, which is,
but I remember they tried to kick her out, I think, of Boston College, and there was this petition that went around, and it was actually a lot of the male students that were trying to get her to be saved, essentially. I thought that was quite telling. But Columba, we've been talking a lot. I want to give you an opportunity to talk about your world, please.
Tell us. Teach us everything.
You're allowed in our class, so you can.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. I want to tie together the womanist theology thread to queer theology, and just highlight that there's a phenomenal pastor, Yvette Flunder, who runs the, what is it called? It's a UCC church in Oakland called the City of Refuge. And she's a phenomenal preacher, a theologian, and you know, that's my sort of great tie-in to queer theology, which you know, in many ways is still developing a consciousness, where we've sort of inherited gay theology. There's a meme, and I realized trying to explain a meme,
I know, it's the worst.
in this format is not ideal. But, and Christy's probably seen it because I've shared it a bunch, but the sort of, the, you know, it's a tweet format, and the top of it says, when they say LGBTQ rights, they mean, and so you've got like a little L in maybe 20 point font, a G in 72 point font, a B sort of in 12, a T that's maybe really just a period, and then Q's sort of just not even on the page.
Yeah.
And so we've queer theology has sort of grown out of gay theology, as most things around LGBTQ issues do. There's that sort of homonormative thing that happens there, that, you know, white gay men are the,
yes,
the palatable,
yeah,
yeah, the, so the palatable version of queers.
We're just cycling back to where we started. But like, not, but you know what I'm saying, like, we're good.
Yeah,
yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, yeah. But it's really evolved out of queer theory, like I said before, that, you know, folks like Michel Foucault, Judith Butler, Eve Sedgwick, you know, have sort of taken the sort of queer theory reality of, you know, queerness as people, as human, and looked to religion to say, what is it about religion that demonizes queerness? So you get that with Michel Foucault, and the history of sex and things like that, and Sedgwick and Butler sort of pick it up and run with it, which ultimately leads us to Marcella.
Yes, Marcella.
Yeah, Marcella's coming out of that Latin America liberation context and says, you know, we can see the Bible as leaning toward the oppressed, and that includes women, queer people, and the things that we do with our bodies. So of course the image of Marcella and the kinky boots speaks to that very, very loudly.
Mm.
But at the heart of it, you know, queer theology is pointing to, you know, theology that is done with, by, and for queer people.
Yeah.
Which of course still largely focuses on that, like, that white cis gay trope of what queerness is, which, you know, I don't know if we can thank Will and Grace for that or something else, but that's the reality, is so much of queer identity is shaped by white cis gay men. But it you know, really focuses in the same way that feminist, womanist, and, you know, other liberative theologies focus on the sort of unshackling of our biblical theological assumptions around who we are as created beings who are, you know, supposedly stamped with the image of God. And I don't want to hog airtime on that, but we celebrated.
Oh, please do. Yeah.
That's why I'm here.
We invited you.
I was going to say, that's why you're here. Please hog all of that time.
I should be selfish about my airtime. I was sitting, I will disclose to the listeners that I was sitting waiting for about 45 minutes. So this is my third glass of wine.
That was my fault.
I gave him a way too early time start.
Yeah.
And then I hit me like, no, sorry.
But it was fine. I mean, I sat here and I was productive, but I haven't eaten since breakfast.
So this Lord.
But also, this is my lunch to be for this podcast. So
that's, and Christy probably wouldn't share this, but, you know, I have the alcohol tolerance of a herd of bison.
Wow.
I mean,
you know, here's the thing. I think
I've already forgotten my own name, so I don't.
There are only a few people. Like, this is a weird thing to brag about, and it's not necessarily a brag, but like, there are only a few people who I feel like can, like, very much outdrink me, and you are definitely one of those people.
I'm one of them. Yeah.
Thanks, Christy. Thanks.
Yeah.
I didn't know my name.
Leah, I just want to remind you of the drag queens in Denver.
Oh my gosh, that's a story. That's a story.
And I'm like three of you, so it's fine. It's fine. But what I was going to say was, this past Saturday we celebrated Finger Lakes Pride in Geneva, New York, which is about 14 miles up the road from me. And it was a really great environment. I think about 3 o'clock I went and spoke with the organizing team, and they'd already had something like 1400 people come through the welcome booths. But I, you know, I was reflecting in our Bible study group at church this morning that of the 32 vendors that were there, two of us were churches. So it was St. Mark's Church, which really encompassed other churches. We had the church in Geneva and the church in Clifton Springs, and our bishop for the Episcopal Diocese of Rochester came, and a retired clergy from down south of us. But adjacent to us was it was two Methodist churches, the Methodist Church from Geneva and Seneca Falls, which of course Seneca Falls has the women's history thing going on. But so, you know, between us and these Methodists, you know, we were sort of capturing a certain audience, and it was not necessarily the people for whom they look at a church booth and say, oh, that's a church. That's mm-hmm. really great. But maybe the people say, oh, that's a church. I'm going to keep walking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it's not an immediate thing that they put together. Oh, they're here because they're affirming or because whatever. And it at least cracks the egg, and maybe something great can come from it someday. But
yeah,
the sort of highlight of where I was going with that was, I was sort of out working the crowd at some point. And I will say that when Christy knew me, I was much more introverted than I seem to be today. I redid the Myers-Briggs last summer, and I think I may beat Christy's extrovert score.
Oh, I don't know that that's possible. I like broke
through that wall. Well, I mean, yeah, but yeah, that's fine. But also look at what the pandemic has done to us, right?
Yeah.
I saw a shirt that says we're all indoor cats now.
Yeah. But so I'm out working the crowd, and this person comes up to me, and so I'm there in a, you know, I'm wearing all black because that's what I do. Sometimes I'm not wearing all black today. I do have black jeans on. But you know, I had my full dog collar. Mm. Over a under a t-shirt that said "This pastor loves you" with the pastor in sort of rainbow like mm-hmm. letters. And so this person comes up and says, "Are you really a pastor?" And I sort of say, "No, I'm just wearing this for comfort, because before anything else, I'm an asshole."
It's a good line.
Yeah. And so they sort of say, "Oh, well, you know, my brother's a Baptist pastor." And he has a lot of opinions about my coming out. And so we you know, I sort of hear their story a little, and you know, the sort of thing that I've taken away from this conversation is they've said to their brother, "It feels to me that you'd be happier for me to just be a eunuch and never, you know, never have an identity, sexual or gender or otherwise.
Yeah.
Then for you to actually embrace who I am becoming." And I, you know, a friend of Christy and I, or a friend of Christy and someone I know, once said to me, you sneeze and prayers come out. And that's kind of what happened. Was I just opened my mouth and words came out. Which is really what happens in all situations, because I don't think I was created with a filter.
Neither were we.
We weren't either.
That's a different episode, though.
That's why you're waiting for 45 minutes. My husband was profusely apologizing for being a male today to me, because I was raging.
As well he should. As well he should.
We had to get through that before I could record.
Yeah, so I'm talking to this person whose name is Dana, and they say, you know, all of this about the Baptist pastor brother.
Yeah,
and I just sort of say, you know, so many people read God and theology and scripture in such a way that even limits, you know, sort of the typical people of the world, you know, the straight cis normative, you know, patriarchy kind of things, that even the way they read God limits that. And so for them to sort of take such a focused, narrow, just limited view of what Genesis means when we hear that God created them in God's image. That even in my queerness and this person's queerness, that God is still visible to those around us.
Yeah.
And, you know, it is such a travesty that, you know, these sort of conservative fundamentalist Christians have the dominant voice in our country, in our, you know, because there's so much more than
Sorry to interject. I think that's the thing.
No.
That seminary, like Leah and I talked about this, you know, I think on our first episode or something. Like, yeah. When did you realize that, like, you know, when I realized I could do this, or when I realized that the box I was in wasn't necessarily correct or whatever. Yeah. And to learn about how theology is done across the globe, across time, across people groups generally, and to see all of the very different ways that it's reflected really allowed me like more space to say, you know, okay, so if God is big enough for all of this, you know, surely we can have some disagreements. We can, you know,
be uncomfortable
with stuff.
I remember when I first started reading Marcel. We're talking about Marcel Altholst Reed, by the way, if you guys.
Earlier I was like, we should say
the whole name. She's just a one named. But I remember when I first read it, and I was so deeply uncomfortable.
Yeah, so uncomfortable. Yeah,
but I was like,
because it has to be, because it's indecent, and that's the point.
If you're not uncomfortable, you're not growing. It's like,
and I wasn't bored.
Yeah.
And two, it's like all of that discomfort, all of those disagreements, all of that stuff. You know what? At the end of the day, we're still supposed to love each other, because that is the thing Jesus said, right? He's like, love God and love other people. And that is the thing Augustine said. Love God and do what you want. And like,
and to continually insist that there is a box that you must fit into is not an exercise of love.
Yeah.
No, it's like, it's an exercise.
You must fit in this cube.
That's right. Yeah. It's control.
That's not love.
It's control.
It's not.
Yes, it's control.
And people who are in charge like to keep their control. And so we saw, you know, I was righteously bitching earlier about the Southern Baptist Convention.
Overthrow those tables.
Yeah, I want to throw the tables. I understand why, like, and I want to not care. And it's interesting because it's like, I want to walk away and say, well, I'm over here doing my stuff, and you know what? Screw you guys. I don't give up flying flip what you're doing. But that's not throwing the tables. That's just letting them keep on. And
it's like, I saw this TikTok last night.
You're so hip, Christy.
I was scrolling as I do to ruin any kind of sleep that I might get as I look at TikTok before I go to sleep. And there was this guy who, sorry, I have now like the rosé hiccups.
That's on you. That's on your choices.
There was this guy saying that there is a Nazi came to his town with a sign that said Hitler was right, and he went and got his own sign that said the only good Nazi is a dead Nazi, and then just started screaming at him. And he was like, get out of our town, you're not welcome here. And but he was like, but sometimes you have to be angry and you have to scream and like Jesus, you have to flip those tables. And
Well, here's a question for you, Columba. I do have, because I remember reading Marcella about the same time as I was reading Radical Love, the Chang.
Oh, yeah. Peter Chang. Peter Chang.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
No. Patrick. Patrick Chang.
And it's been a minute, and there's been some wine. But also, and I remember reading his book and thinking, wow, that would be a great introduction to a church, because there's even like study questions at the end of it and stuff.
Yeah.
And then reading Marcel and being like, wow, I don't think I could ever take that to a church, you know? And so, but for, you know, and I wonder, do you think that these topics, at least if we're talking about the organized church, largely speaking, do you think that it needs to kind of be shocked or be softly introduced? You know, like, I don't know the answer.
Yeah.
I mean,
it doesn't have to be those authors specifically, but just.
No, yeah. I lean into the shock.
Mm.
But as someone oriented toward pastoral care, which is, you know, however many percents of my job,
mm-hmm.
There it has to be done tactfully, and there has to be a layer of trust.
Mm. Yeah.
So it's intriguing that this question comes up, because in Bible study today, following this very same conversation about my new trans friend, you know, one of our really dedicated, really passionate theological thinking lay women said to me, you know, one of the things that I sort of remember standing out in our interview with Columba when he first came and was, you know, discerning a call to St. Mark's, was that he identified himself as queer.
Mm.
And this woman is 77. She has a background as a school administrator. Uh-huh. And so she says, for the last 50, 70 years, whatever, I have thought queer as a dirty word, that you don't say it. And here was someone saying it and identifying it, and, you know, and the conversation turned toward reclamation and the reality that, you know, whether you want to call it tone policing or, you know, whatever other term that Ron DeSantis would call us woke for using, you know, in many ways, we have to write our own stories. And it's not up to us to be, it's not an invitation for us to be palatable to everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And so mm-hmm. when you have the sort of difference between Marcella or Patrick Cheng, you know, Patrick Cheng, who is an Episcopalian, is much more palatable. Because
mm-hmm.
you know he's a cis gay.
Rome, tell me more.
But and that's not meant to be shady. I mean, we're Facebook friends. I think he's done a lot of really good and powerful things for this church.
Yeah.
And at the same time, I think it needs to go further. Mm. One of the great mm-hmm. barriers of LGBTQ issues in the Episcopal Church, especially, is once we got to gay marriage, mm-hmm. once we got to 2015 and gay marriage was a thing, everyone sort of said, okay, well done, let's go home.
Yeah.
But there's so much more to keep doing. And especially now in a political environment where everyone seems to care who uses what bathroom.
Yeah.
You know, that
yep.
that has a theological basis.
Excuse me.
You know, how we understand biology, like you said on last week's episode, you know, all of academia comes out of theological colleges.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
Everything we understand about existence in the Western world comes from theology.
Yeah.
From a theological circumstance. And for us to take someone like Patrick Cheng into Bible study or you know, a book discussion group and say, here's a rationale for why we need to care about LGBTQ issues in the world is a really nice, sensitive way to do it.
Yeah.
Keyword nice, and, though.
Can I offer nice. A compromise?
And, yeah.
I'm sure you've read it, because I know that I read it when we were still in Glasgow, but Lynn Tonstad's book.
So you actually sent that to me because you read it after I left, but it was only shortly after, because I had just moved into the rectory at St. Mary's, so it was probably November 2018.
Okay.
Which one is it? The queer theology one?
The queer theology book.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was trying to remember the name of it, but yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think the thing with that is, well, you all can tell me what you think, but it's, you know, with Lynn, brilliant, just beyond brilliant.
Brilliant.
And have drank red wine with her in the past as well.
She's a fantastic person to drink wine with.
She's a fantastic person to drink wine with. Gave me my first Negroni. I never had a Negroni before.
I was there. Yeah. She did. She slipped it to Leah.
She did. She slipped it. I forgot about it until I got on the plane and then I remembered. But do you think it's a little too, because there's accessible.
No, because queer theology, I don't know if you've read, queer theology is not a very academic book.
Okay. No, I haven't. So I haven't.
Her other stuff is.
I was going to say, is it too dense?
Yeah.
Is what my
her other stuff is really high level, very, very academic. But queer theology, she really wrote for people.
Fair.
I think I read through it in probably just a few days.
Amazing. It was really short. Perfect. It was really quick.
Yeah,
I just really appreciate it. In the beginning, she was like, I am not here to argue for my existence.
Yeah.
I need to move the conversation farther. Yes. And I was like, yeah, because that's really all that's been happening.
Yeah.
It was, I really enjoyed that just kind of stance. I'm not here because we can have the, I mean, we're not going to have those conversations because none of us here are biblical scholars, but like, you can go over
what
to, right
we are ministers of the Lord.
we are the queen of the sciences here.
Speak for yourself.
You can go to the biblical scholars and you can ask them about those verses and be like, what does this mean, and we can have all those conversations, but like, that has been done for decades, and if you're not willing to hear what's already been said about it, there's nothing else we can do for you. You know,
and that's the sort of struggle that I think the Methodist Church has encountered in their disaffiliation debacle, is you've got little pockets of the country that, you know, whether they've been led by conservative bishops or they've had conservative pastors for 40 years or whatever the circumstance is, you have people who are so sort of indoctrinated, feels like a strong word, but I'm going to use it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. To think that queer people are tearing apart the fiber of humanity, that everything that's wrong with the world is because of queer people. And you know, you've got these pockets that are so convinced, and I saw a bumper sticker, and I later figured out who it belonged to, and we had a fabulous conversation about this. But the bumper sticker read, "It is so much easier to." Oh shit!
See, that's what happens at this hour. The white wine hits.
It is. It is so easier to fool someone than to convince them they've been fooled.
Ooh.
And that's, you know, that is applicable to Ron DeSantis and certain other political leaders of our time. But looking at this specific thing, when you grow up knowing or being told, being indoctrinated, right, that queerness is bad, that you know, the queers are going to hell because that's where they belong, because they do butt stuff or whatever. You know, there's this sort of,
it's gonna be awful crowded down there with all.
I was gonna say,
I know. Yeah. But it's created this really awful environment that doesn't allow you to think outside of that reality that you're sort of built into. And, you know, one of the great gifts that St. Mark's gives to me is I'm like pastor number 7 who is some stripe of LGBTQ.
Mm.
You know, I don't have to come in and do the work.
Mm. Yeah.
And I can come in and do the advocacy that's needed in this community. I mean, Yates County, New York is still a bright red county.
Yeah.
And, you know, we are the progressive church in Yates County.
Yeah.
And we have that as our mission in the world. And it's not every church's mission. Not every church is going to do this work. But for the people for whom it's needed, there needs to be the churches that can say, you know, you are just as deserving of eternal life, and you are just as imprinted with the image of God as the rest of us.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And you spoke about the Methodist, you know, I'm in the Methodist world. I teach Methodist ministers now. Yeah. And it's tearing them apart. And mm-hmm. it's one of the things I will say is that I saw a graph of how many. So those of you who maybe don't know out there, the Methodist Church just very recently had a vote. And I think it was it to affirm LGBT pastors?
It wasn't even that reaching it. It was to sort of open the potential.
Okay.
To do that.
Jeez.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, so, but yeah, so anyway, and there was a choice, United My Ass, that they could disaffiliate, if yeah. they didn't essentially agree with it. And it's yeah. been really a thing, and it's really, I can see the hurt in a lot of my students' eyes
yeah.
that
yeah.
my master students who are training for ministry. And yeah. you know, I will say that the percentage though that have that's the best noise. That have disability.
Oh no, it's empty.
Oh no.
No.
That was the end of it.
Oh. You just gotta go take your little boat down the lake and get scared. Go pick some grapes. But the percentage is actually pretty small that have actually chosen yeah. which is I will say very exciting. But back to something that you said prior, it's interesting because there's all these debates, you know. Yeah, and we talked about that Florida guy and all of that stuff.
I know, it's devastating here.
I mean, you know, whatever. We had the bathroom stuff in North Carolina. It's a whole thing too. But we're on the battlegrounds, guys. That's something we can say.
Mm-hmm.
But this idea too is that they're going after. They are going after trans, you know, rights and things like that.
Right.
And then they're also saying, we saw this week in the Southern Baptist Church, women can't be ministers.
Uh-huh.
And again, if you break apart these arguments, it isn't about religion anymore. It's not about created beingness. It's who are you affirming here? Wait, we're back to that conversation again.
Yeah. It's always just about power and wanting to keep the power. And I mean, honestly, it's the thing, like, I mean, all of this is wrapped up in is what Gutierrez was saying. It's what James Cone was saying. It's how do we understand that what the story we see about Jesus, which is what all of this is supposed to be like centered on. I don't mean to get super Bartian here, but Jesus,
you need
Jesus
more wine.
Is the thing, right?
Get more wine.
It's about how we understand God through the person and the work of Jesus. And if that's the focus and Jesus was oppressed, Jesus was homeless, Jesus was poor, Jesus was, you know, good job. Jesus was often defined as a drunkard. My favorite part of that.
Definitely drank wine.
As we drink our wine, Jesus would approve. The point is not to be like, how do we get control of the empire? How do we have you know, all the money? How do that? That's never been what we're supposed to be doing, and yet that's the thing.
The money stuff gets me a lot sometimes, Christy. I'll be honest, because he was very clear about the money.
Very
absolutely. That just has, especially with things like not even the prosperity gospel, but this whole, like, I don't know, I think it's a Gen Z thing. It's definitely not an elder millennial thing, which is what I am, but like the hustle culture of like, if you just and God will bless you and all this stuff. And I'm like, I don't remember any of that.
You know what's so strange to me is that even outside of like obvious prosperity gospels, I remember looking back when I was a kid and my parents kind of being like we don't, because when I was like 1 to 10, I guess we were a little bit more, I'm not trying
weirdly to vague and weirdly specific at the same time.
When I turned 10, my dad got a job at a bank, and then we were not struggling.
Damn.
Prior to that.
Yeah. Hashtag humble brag.
I know. Like, look, I acknowledge my privilege. That was my major part of it. But like prior to that, my parents would be like, you know, here are our friends and they have all this money and why doesn't God love us like that? And like, it's just, I don't know. It like, I just was very confused about it as a kid. Cause I was like, God loves us. Like we just live our lives. Like, why are we so weirdly focused on this money part? But now I have to pay my own bills. I'm like,
tell me about it.
You know, like, God, could you love me a little bit more? But
a little bit more,
But
she
really
says at the beach at Florida.
I was gonna say you're on vacation this week while the rest of us are working.
Look,
so
I'm not working.
I am still Leah's on vacation. I have online classes. I was in the office interviewing people today.
That's your penance. That's your penance.
I'm pretty sure she was at the pool yesterday.
I was at the pool.
She sent me a message telling me how
it was on Instagram.
How sad she was about how hot she was at the pool.
It was so hot. I had to get into the water twice.
Oh my god.
It was 60 degrees here today. I am wearing flannel.
Oh Jesus, no.
Just saying. It was also like 85 degrees on Saturday. So.
Like, we've all lived in Scotland. We can't complain.
It's true. I was like, the Scottish are currently melting to death.
And oh yeah, they are. They are.
They're all boiling.
My mother-in-law was like, my mother-in-law who lives in Aberdeenshire was like, it's hot. And every time a Scottish person says it's hot, it's like not a like it's hot exclamation. It's like, it's hot. You may not hear from me again.
Like,
but their high today is 80. And let's be real. We all lived in Scotland when it was 80 degrees and there is no air conditioning.
Oh, there's no air conditioning. Well, and our friend Helen,
and it's humid.
He was like,
yeah,
our buildings are designed to retain heat.
100%.
Yes. So her inside of her home was hotter than it was outside. And I was like, that is the thing I remember being miserable is that it's like, like the temperature doesn't look hot, but there's nowhere to like cool off.
I was telling her, I was like, I was an external examiner at a London college. Mm. And I remember it was a heat wave, quote unquote, but it really was a heat wave. And they stuck me in like a basement with a bunch of like, final exam and just opened it. They're like, we'll crack a window.
Smell terrible.
Cracked a window. And I was like, I'm a Southern girl. And I was like, I might die here. I'll die in a basement in London. It'll be so 1800s true crime. I can't wait. For it.
They'll
just stick me in a well somewhere and they'll find me.
None of those people were made for heat, but also none of their buildings were made for heat.
Right.
We are coming up on 87 minutes, which is absolutely delightful. Oh. I wanted to ask if you had any last statements, but the sad part is we reached the end of the podcast, but we're like at the height of the drinking, which is the fun part.
It's the worst part.
But I did have it. There was a question that we had, I think on Twitter, that was, what was our favorite Scottish saying? And I feel like this would be a good question for
us. This is a great question.
Well, considering the weather, it has to be Tapsaf.
Tapsaf.
Tapsaf.com is my favorite Scottish website.
Oh, is that a
thing? Absolutely.
It's a map that tells you if it's Tapsaf in your area or not. So, will you please define for our listeners what Tapsaf is?
I was going to say,
So if we translate it into American, it is tops off. And it says if the weather is pleasant enough for you to be outside, probably for Ben to be outside with their tops off.
Yes.
And they're going to take their tops off with no sunscreen.
They're going to be blindingly white at the beginning of the day and then a literal lobster at the end of the day.
Yes. I did have a closing comment, and
please do.
In my Facebook memories like 10 days ago, but in 2018, which is now 5 years ago, Christy and I went on this really lovely adventure together, and I don't actually remember what we did. I just remember that one of the photos from that day was me standing in front of the Big Willie distillery sign.
Nice. Nice.
But we ended up back at my apartment and fulfilled one of Christy's lifelong wishes, and that was to have a surprise party.
It was the greatest
for her birthday.
You've never had a surprise party
until that
no,
day.
No, she has had one surprise party.
Well, of course, yes.
Pretty. And truly, and wow. Maybe this is my own fault, but like I have told every human I have ever known that I wanted a surprise party, and no one had ever given me one.
Could be part just only being reflective. That could be part of your problem.
It absolutely. I mean, how do you throw a surprise party for somebody who's regularly asking you to throw them a surprise party? I understand.
Well, Columba, how did you do it?
We just went on an adventure, and I have no idea what we did. I think that was the day we sat.
I remember.
So drinking.
Was that the day we went to Waterstones and sat down in the coffee shop down in Waterstones?
No.
For like 3 hours.
We went to the People's Palace in Glasgow. Which
oh, that's
is,
right.
How yes. do we describe the People's Palace? It's like a little museum
slash botanic garden slash
whatever they decide
with
to
a really hunky barista.
I think it's closed now, which is devastating.
Oh.
And then we went to City Center, and you started making me go to the strangest stores.
Mm. Well, like, because I was trying to buy time.
You were trying to buy time.
Everyone showed up.
You were like, let's go into this coffee or this chocolate shop. And I was like, what?
Oh, my God. The chocolate shop at that hotel.
Yeah. But, yes, it was one of my favorite things. And we got back to Columba's apartment, and all of our friends were there, and I was, I mean, just beyond touched that I had only been there for 9 months at that point. And just really, like, amazingly beyond touched that they had all conspired to actually throw me a surprise party.
You weren't just saying it was my idea.
Hashtag humblebrag too. Christy was super freaking rich, and Columba can throw a freaking surprise party.
That's right. And she had no idea. We walked into my flat, and she was like, "Why is this door closed?" And I was like,
"It was like, what is happening right now?"
And so I was like, "Just go in and wake him up." And she walked in, and there were like 15 people in our lounge that were like, surprise.
It was great.
And Christy,
did you cry? Did you cry?
She cried. I have video proof.
There is video of it. Yeah.
I love a good cry.
There is
video of it.
This is before you were even the replacement Leah, which is what you became later.
It is. It's before I became replacement Leah. It was before I met all those people.
When Columba, whenever she met my friends, because I'd left at that stage to come back to the States, and they just kept calling.
Yeah, and I just barely knew each other.
Yeah, we were passing in probably for the best. But they kept calling her replacement Leah,
which I was so mad about.
It was, but for an extrovert, I think it hit deep.
It cut to the quick. Okay. Leah, do you want to say your favorite?
Now we're at like 92 minutes.
I know.
Right?
I know. It's fine. I don't care. It's our podcast. We can do it.
No one's made it this far. No one's made it this far.
I warned them. I said, buckle up. It's going to be a long one.
I know. But also, I just like talking to you. So would you come back on our podcast again?
I will be back as long as you don't make me wait for 45 minutes. Because...
we can't confirm that. We can't confirm or deny.
How many times have I made you wait 45 minutes? It's been a lot of times.
I appreciate that you request that, and it will be logged into our official log. But we can't confirm. Can't confirm.
No, that's fine.
But
I will
you can
come at any time.
You can start drinking ahead of time, which I mean, that's always an option.
That's what I did.
I mean, we would strongly suggest that if we make anyone wait for that amount of time.
I have a lot of other things to say. So, I'm very opinionated.
I mean, same.
Oh, we're not. So, we're wilting violets, so it's fine.
That's true. Leah, what's your favorite
Scottish
phrase?
Anyone listening to that believes that.
Scottish phrase.
My favorite Scottish phrase is "for fuck's sake."
Yeah.
That's a great one, right? I still say that just regularly. It's amazing because it's such a, I will say when I lived, because I did live in Belfast for a year, and crack
is good. Yeah.
Crack is good because it's like, what's the crack? Mm-hmm. What are you doing? You know, what's the crack like?
I remember the first time I came back to the States and I said, oh, that was some good crack. And like,
yeah, it's difficult when people are like,
yes,
did you go see some builders or something? Like, what do you mean? But like, so I think that one, but I do think the one I use the most, which is just for fuck's sake. And it can be like a joy. I love the sort of Scottish / I guess Gaelic words. They can mean so many things. Like I could say, for fuck's sake.
Yeah. Or it could be inflection.
Yeah. Or it can be like, for fuck's sake. Like, you know, it could be any, and the same with crack is like, you know, most of the time I say it to my husband who's Scottish and I'll be like, what's a crack? Which is just basically like what being married is, which is asking what you're doing every day until you die. And so I'll just say like, he'll be at work. It'll be like 4:59. And I'm like, what's the crack?
Yeah.
And so I would say those are my two favorites.
Mine is Digi-I.
Digi-I. Oh, that's a good one. Yeah.
Because I feel like it really encompasses how I approach most conversations with people. Is they'll be telling me something and I'm just like, oh, Digi-I.
It's the blusher heart of Scotland.
It is the blusher heart of Scotland. Like, did you really, did you really do that? Oh.
I remember the first time that Helen, our friend Helen McLaughlin, shout out, said it to me because I think I had done something and I was genuinely proud of myself.
And then she comes with a DJI and you're
and
just
she like, was like, oh, DJI. And I was like, oh yeah, no, I did. I did. I really did.
And then you're immediately knocked down 10 pegs. Yeah.
Yeah. And then later she was like, you know that I didn't really care that you did that. And I was like, but again, the beauty at Columbia, you'll discover this of being an extrovert, is that you don't care.
Well, I don't think I ever actually cared. I think I was always an extrovert in hiding. Ooh. So when I redid the Myers-Briggs last summer, you know, the like official Myers-Briggs, I sent my results to someone and my extrovert score was like 87. And they said, you might be an extrovert, but you're still a misanthrope. Which, I mean, for my alternate Scottish phrase, you wee cunt.
Oh, yeah. Good one.
I've had to sort of call from my verbal life, but I think at 20 times a day, I mean, if the stapler jams, if, you know, if I walk into my desk, it's in my head.
I remember I told my other half, he was like, what can I say in front of your parents? I was like, don't say GD and don't say cunt. I was like, that's it. Because Scots just curse like it's normal. And I'm like, he doesn't mean anything by it. I'm like, those are just two.
It's a term of endearing. Mm-hmm. I had a friend who was giving a paper and she's Scottish and she was giving a paper in Boston and she texted me and said, how much swearing can I do? I was like, well, maybe it's not your audience. How American are they?
I was gonna say. And with what swear words? Because in the UK, well, Scotland, I'll say, cunt's not a bad, well, it's a bad word, but it's, yeah, it's a term of, a term of endearment.
Like you almost hear it more positively than you do negatively, you know? Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And here it's just like, I don't know if it's like the height of bad words, but it's pretty close up there.
It is pretty close.
It's top of the pile, I think.
Well, hey, this was lovely. I am devastated to end it, but I am aware that
why are you cutting us off, Christy?
I know,
oppression,
I'm so sad.
Oppression.
I am.
I'm going to write about you at the next moment. Book.
I will dismantle your house with your tools.
Please dismantle this house.
I will just write about you and go on other podcasts and talk about it. because I have no tools.
No loyalty.
My podcast breakthrough, so
I don't have any tools. So unfortunately, I don't own.
Everyone will want me on their podcasts. I'm looking at you, Trip Hudgens, you hear this? I'm just kidding.
We've already said we want Beth Moore on here. You can come on if she.
I know. She responds. Can you imagine Beth Moore on our podcast? We're like, Beth, you have to have a drink.
She might be all right with it now.
She might. Don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know her feels. You know who we also.
God bless
Beth Moore. What? Who? Who's the next? What about that guy that you don't like, Christy, that I don't know because I'm not on Twitter? The guy that you said you didn't like, the theologian?
Oh.
Maybe? You don't have to say his name.
Do you mean that devil man who blocked me?
Oh.
Okay. Was the proudest day of my life.
Eric Metaxas?
Yes, I am proudly blocked by Eric Metaxas because I wrote an article about him.
Well, Eric Metaxas can eat an ass.
He is the worst. And
I don't want to give him that privilege. He can go.
Walk off a short bridge.
By a copperhead. That's what we will say.
But he blocked me.
Let's not get sued for libel.
Because of a post I wrote, or a little piece I wrote on him, which said it's for SCM.
Was it called toxic masculinity?
No, it was called like the only things certain are death and Metaxas.
That's a good title. That's a really good title.
The SCM lovely people came up with it for me.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Well,
I think Eric Metaxas would be a phenomenal guest. He on a week that die. You don't invite.
I don't even know what he does, and I'm.
We would eviscerate Christy. Him. He makes up false histories about theologians, and then it's like, look, and I'm an expert on this person. No, you're not.
Are they like just like the theologians everyone talks about, or are they like?
He wrote a really horrible book. What Tillich? Bonhoeffer.
Oh, Bonhoeffer, not Tillich. Yeah.
I want to learn more about Bonhoeffer, and then they're like, "Oh, here's this very popular book by Eric Metaxas about Bonhoeffer. What you do with that book is you throw it straight in the garbage, kind of like I did with the Redneck Martini. Same energy.
You know, I was willing to try that, but
I was disappointed that you threw it out. That was a waste.
I took a sip, and I couldn't do it.
I'm just saying that's not how we roll down here. You just gotta pinch your nose and go for it.
Oh
Lordy. Anyway.
on that note, y'all, I gotta go because my husband's returned with the dog.
Oh. Well, go.
That's not why I've gotta go.
Give Stuart our love. Hey, this is great. I love you all.
That sounded totally genuine, Christy.
Good. So sober.
You definitely hesitated.
Hello, everyone. I love you.
I love you.
I love you, everyone.
I don't think she's going to remember that.
And that's fine. I'll remind her of it later.
I'll remember when I listen back tomorrow.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. We recorded this. Damn it.
We recorded
this. Yeah, that was kind of the point, you guys.
I know. All right. Well, all right. I'll talk to you guys later. And it was lovely meeting you, Clumba.
You too. I will talk to you in a few weeks, I'm sure, because I'm going to bully my way back onto this.
This is what we do. It's just shooting the shit with the educated vibe.
Yeah.
That's cool. Gin and tonics next time.
Ooh. Well, you're going to have to tell me the gin because I've not been converted yet, but I will go with you. I'll go with you on the journey.
Okay.
We're going to do it when she's here and I have the good gin to give her.
Oh, that's good. That's good.
All right. Bye, y'all.
Bye.
Bye. May God bless you, whoever she is.
There we go.
That was sweet.
Love it.
Bye.